Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It was on this date, August 15th, 1945, at noon, Japan Standard Time, that Japan's Emperor Hirohito announced Japan's surrender to the Allies, marking the end of World War II. That announcement certainly came as a relief to Lucille Hoda of Kimball, South Dakota, because it meant her husband, Fred Hoda, would soon be coming home. Hoda, a sergeant in the Army's 45th Fighter Squadron, was involved in some of the most brutal fighting of the war in the Pacific, on Iwo Jima. He saw many comrades die, saw the famous flag raising on Mount Suribachi, and the Enola Gay on its way to dropping the atomic bomb. In short, Fred Hoda was a witness to history. He'll turn 90 in February. In our recorded conversation, he talks about how his World War II experience began with the Army in 1942.
I was inducted into a unit that went to Seattle, Washington, and from there we went to Hawaii, where I was assigned to the 45th Fighter Squadron, and from there on I just kept moving farther into the Pacific. Like Iwo and Canton and Kwajalein and those islands. I never did get back to the United States until the war was over. See, and that was, of course, after my last stop was Iwo Jima. And it was quite a stop to make. I don't want another one like that. We were off offshore while they were throwing the big shells off of the ships onto Iwo Jima, but they weren't destroying anything because everything was underground.
The Japanese were underground.
The Japanese were all underground there, and we finally had to go in, and of course when they thought that they had everything blew off of the island, well then we were going to come in. And it took 13 bunches of landers before they ever got one on shore, and that would have been on February 19th, 1945, I think it was Invasion Day. And boy, when they first started coming in, well then. The Japs would have had all this heavy bombardment equipment underground, and then they just come up. And then when they first brought the first one around, the invasion unit around to go in to shore, well, then the Japs brought up their big guns off just underneath, and that bombardment didn't bother them that way.
So, in other words, you're bombing the shore, and the Japanese are with their equipment are under the sand.
And even the big guns were on a hydraulic system that went underneath the ground. And then when they started the invasion, the Japanese the GIs from the ships were loaded onto the landing craft. Why then they brought the big guns up from underneath the ground and start blasting in the hell. They couldn't. In fact, it had to take so many landing craft as it did was because there were so many of the landing craft that they had GIs on them. They had fighting men on them, and they also had equipment. You know, certain a lot of the equipment was going. And they wouldn't get on land. They would just before they hit the land, where the Japs didn't come up out of their caves, so to speak, and they would just blow them out of the water. And then the shore, they had a hell of a time because the shore was so littered with blown up landing crafts and their equipment and stuff.
What was it like for you to come off that ship and charge that island and go at these Japanese soldiers? What can you describe what that was like?
Pretty hard. When we first started getting into what the action was, believe it or not, there was times when I felt like I'd like to run and crawl under some bed someplace and hide. I mean, I wasn't one of them heroes, I guess, that they jumped up and said, "Hey, I'll take you and run out there and take them away." I was scared. Yeah, I don't know what else to describe it as. And of course, the main objective was to keep my butt underground so I wouldn't get shot at. If I didn't get shot, that was, I guess, maybe the biggest reason.
Did you lose some buddies on that island?
Oh, yes. I saw that the statistics after the war, and they said there was approximately 4,600 GIs that were killed on that island. And the island is small. It was only about 4.5 miles long. And about, and the narrowest part of the island was, a quarter mile probably, 400 yards maybe, from one shore to the exit. That's where, because it was big on one end, and then it comes down to a little peninsula that stuck out into the water. So the island was small. You didn't, and from one end to the other, it was only 4.5 miles long. That's not very much.
How brutal was the fighting?
They say that was probably one of the bloodiest battles that the United States ever fought in. One was that it was 15 days was the longest that the bodies had to lay out on the sand before they could get hold of them, do anything with them.
The bodies of the deceased soldiers.
Yes. And so then they would gather them all up and throw them in a big pile. And then the guys that would was responsible for them, well, they would sit around this big pile and take the bolts, dog tags off of them. And then take, if there's a rust, they'd cut their hand off and take the watch off of their hand and put them in a sack. And figures with rings, but then they just cut the figure off and put, and that was their job. And it was 15 days before they could start to do that, because it's such close contact there, because you didn't have a deal where you could fire from your line of scrimmage and then wait a while, maybe in 2 days, while then maybe you could try again. Because once you got on that small island, you was there to take it. You had to take it or get blown to bits.
It, from what I understand, it took quite some time to take the island. As you mentioned, it took a lot longer than some of the other islands. And was it because the Japanese were just so dug in and the fighting was so fierce?
Well, I believe that's correct. When I was with the 45th Fighter Squadron, and we went in with the Marines, because there was three airstrips on that island, and the middle airstrip was the biggest, and that's the one that we were interested in to use for our base. See, but we couldn't go into that, so we had to try for the smaller one. And then work our way up to take it. If you don't understand what I mean by taking it, moving in, and then of course we had, after we had the island secured, the south side, south part of it, the north part where they, it was up in the, up in the. It's a funny thing because when we invaded it, we were around lower. We just looked, and there was a, just like a mountain, just like a mountain was up there, and the Japs. We had the bottom part secured, but they were still up there. See, but then while they were up there, well then we were making arrangements to get the 45th Fighter Squadron in, to a, because then we could fly. It was 750 miles from there to Tokyo, and then it gave us an escort base. Now, excuse me, maybe.
Let me let you catch your breath here. Fred Hoda is our guest, talking about his World War II experiences on Iwo Jima, and describing the way the Japanese were dug in up top on those mountains. Was that would that have been Mount Suribachi or near there?
That was at the very end, a volcano. It stuck up there. When I say mountains, and you think of mountains in the United States, well, it wasn't that kind of a mountains. It was just, the land was just higher, that was all. And then we would have to, and they were up there, and they had an advantage point then. Of course, they were up above us, down low. It was tough. It was tough.
You were talking earlier about getting those landing strips, taking those landing strips away from the Japanese and using that as a launching point.
Well, we were supposed to go in the, and get that middle one and get it ready for the planes to come in from Saipan, which was 750 miles away. And there it was, and so they wanted to secure that island because it was then 750 miles from there to Tokyo. So it was some place to, well, just like for instance when that bomber took the first bomb into Japan, atomic bomb. Well, they had engine trouble, and so they landed on the Iwo Jima.
The Enola Gay?
Yes, yeah. Nobody knew why. They strung up a big deal all the way around them, but nobody knew that there was an atomic bomb on the thing, but they got the engine fixed, and they took off again, and went on and dropped their bomb. And that was the purpose of taking an island, because we had once we could bring our outfit into the to the island, 45th Fighter Squadron, why then we were there, and then the bombers from Saipan, which is 750 miles from us, would make their run for Japan. Well, then they'd get halfway there, and then we'd go up to join them, and we would fly escort for them. And then when they come to where they're going to drop their bombs, to the big island in Japan, well, then we took the fighter planes, and they didn't go in, because then the artillery, anti-aircraft guns would be blasting away there at the bombers, so they just stand out there. And then when they dropped their bomb, the planes, then they would turn around and come back, and then we would come down to join them and fly escort again, because then they were doing the same thing. The Japs was keeping their fighter planes away from there because they were busy firing at the bombers. They didn't want to get their own ship shut up, you know. So then we'd take contact and we'd keep them fighters off of the bombs until they come back to Iwo Jima.
There are probably not a lot of people who know that the Enola Gay landed on Iwo Jima on the way to Japan to drop the atomic bomb. How much of that did you see in terms of the preparation and the bomb itself? No, nothing.
Didn't even know. All thought it was a bomber going up to Japan, and he fixed his engine, and he sent them on his way. We didn't even know until after it was all over with, then we knew it.
You made the connection then.
Yeah, because there wasn't anybody on Iwo Jima. When the bomber left Saipan and was going for Japan proper to drop their bomb, they would fly. We were right in between, right in there, 750 miles, 750, it's like a hop, so you and they never told us why the bomber had landed, except that, well, he had engine trouble. That was all of it. But then they went on their way and dropped their bomb.
And there's all kinds of debate, and it continues today, about whether the United States should have done what it did. Many people feel that it was necessary because it was what ended the war, and it saved many American soldiers' lives. From your standpoint, when it did happen, is there any way to even put into words what a relief it must have been, knowing that this is finally going to come to an end?
We didn't think about what was going to happen tomorrow. And in other words, when we went in for the invasion of Iwo Jima, we knew what we was going there for. But once we landed and we were busy with everything else, particularly saving Hornets again, say, well, boy, we did the right thing, tomorrow's going to be better, we just too damn busy with, we was always occupied with right now here. That's what we were busy with most all the time.
How often did you think to yourself, did you wonder, am I going to survive this? Am I going to make it?
No. If it looks a little scary, we're just too damn concerned with trying to bury ourselves. I see, when we landed, Iwo Jima was an island from the volcano. That's naturally, and it's all sand. Except when you got up on the north end of the island, the big end of the island, it's up higher. Well, there would be a tree once in a while growing there or something, and there were some people, Japanese, living there. Now, whether they were servicemen or what, I don't know, but that's where they were occupied. Because I can remember one instance when it was guns were firing 24 hours a day on that island when he first went in. I mean, it was that way. I remember we had taken the small end of the island, which was where Suribachi was on. It had come to the island where it branched out and become a big, like a ball. That was one end. The Japs was up there, and it was just fear. It's just like living in the city, I can imagine, and you just hear the traffic all 24 hours a day. If you left a small town like Kimball at nighttime, well, you hardly hear anything. It's like all at once where the shooting stopped. You begin to wonder what the hell's going on there. Then finally, they called their attention to this guy. It was a Japanese guy. We had the small planes from Saipan fly over. Probably it was the day before. And they dropped leaflets, paper leaflets on the just on the airplane. They just landed all over how you can imagine what you did. On one side it was all red and the printing was in white. and you turned it over, and it was just like our, then it was ours. It's all white and turned it back. And you could read this one, but this was Japanese. This was ours. This was an instruction for them. Come on out, your hands over your head, no weapons. Take your clothes off. And so after they dropped those, so I don't remember when it was, whether it was night or toward morning. It seems to me it was the day before, and then the next morning, this happened. There was one Jap come out to the edge of this ridge up there, and that's what he was. He had no gun. His hands was over his head, and no clothes on him, and just real quiet. And I don't know whether it was 2 seconds or 10 minutes. I don't have any idea. It was just quiet, and there it was. And then all hell broke loose. See, now they
what happened?
Well, everybody down below started blowing to bits. Blew him to bits. I mean, they just, everybody opened up on him and see that he could see him. And now, why the hell would they, what I always wondered afterwards in my own mind, why do you drop the instructions for them to do it? And then when they go to do it, then you blast at them, then nobody's going to go. They and no Japanese, they saw that too, you know. And they say, well, hell, I'm not going to go out and do that, but they're just going to blow me up, see? So they just kept right on going.
Yeah. So we dropped instructions for telling them how to surrender. The guy follows the instruction, gets blown to bits, and that, I guess, made them dig in even more.
We wouldn't surrender. If that was our case, it'll mean it to hell. I believe it. You ain't going to believe them. And nobody surrendered. I mean,
it's interesting to me because what I'm getting from what you're telling me is that in spite of all you went through and how hard it was, I'm hearing sympathy from you for the Japanese soldiers, for maybe what some of the other side went through.
Well, on that part, yes. I mean, we told them what to do in surrender, and they could have, but when the one guy, they sent this one guy out there, and I'm sure that's why he came out, just to see what would happen, and what happened, it wasn't what we asked them to do, so. They weren't going to fight it. They just kept right on fighting. Hell, after the fighting stopped, and the Japanese flew in some hierarchy, and I didn't even see it. I wasn't where I could see it. I mean, and in fact, the planes were coming and going, and you wasn't paying any attention to them. This guy, he come in for the Japanese to tell them, he was some general, that the island, he had a big bullhorn, and he'd go over the island, drove him around the island and tell them that the war was over, the Japanese lost, and the surrender, and the Japs was all in the caves underneath the ground, see? When he did that, they were trying to talk those Japanese to come out from those, but they wouldn't come out because they saw what happened when he dropped the brief and told you to come out, and so the Japs stayed there. Hell, there were Japs underground and coming out at nights to get water. Water was a son of a gun there. You couldn't. We had little outfits that took the water out of the ocean, they renewed the water, so it's come out, you could drink it.
Take the salt out of it?
Yeah, I took the salt out. And then we were rationed one corporation, canteen a day, one of those little ones like that, if you could get to one of them, see. And there just wasn't any water, any fresh water there. They had to make the fresh water out of that little island. And
how close were you to when the flag raising, the famous iconic photograph of that flag raising occurred on Mount Suribachi?
Well, we were in the narrow part of the island. It was only about 400 yards over there. In fact, we didn't even see it. We didn't even see it until they called our attention to it. See, then is when that guy, they landed this newspaper man on there to take a picture, and then they restaged it all over again. But hell, it was way up there on top of Suribachi. And hell, we were doing our job down below. There was so much that was going on. You didn't know that.
What was your when you did see it, and you know when they did restage it and you saw it? What did you think about? What how did it make you feel?
Well, it. I don't think we just felt anything. We looked up there and I see that there. I thought to ourselves, "Well, boy, we got the Suribachi, which is the last end of that island. We got that under control." We didn't. In other words, I think maybe what you're thinking that we would we should be thinking jump up and down and cheer and sing and wave a flag, and you didn't feel any of that because you was too damn busy with your own work, trying to save your own hide and move up farther up to get rid of the rest of the island. And all it was what four guys had raised the flag, and the rest of the, well, there was a lot of dead guys on the ground at that time that didn't get to see it. So it wasn't, I don't know. I just can't say in words what we felt like when we see it there. We see it up there. All it told us was that we had the rest of the island on that end, and we still got the main part to go up there.
Well, Fred Hoda, you've shared a lot with us, and I appreciate it, and I know that our listeners do too. And thank you so much for visiting with us, and I hope that it was good for you to talk about it.
Why there? How many people? How many of us are alive yet that was on Iwo Jima? I would just say there's damn few. I would say. Because we're pretty old, and I'm alive at my age. By then, you figure, boy, oh boy, there ain't very many of them left. So it's nice. It's right. I think that some individuals should inquire about it to have knowledge of it, because the rest of us are going to be dead here in a few months, probably. Why, then you're not going to be able to get all that stuff, except the baloney that they put out sometimes.
Well, I'm awfully glad I was able to get the story from you, and I hope you're here for a whole lot longer. Thank you, Fred.
Thank you.